This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 92nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have today with me, John Callis.
Thank you very much for having me here.
So you've been on the net since 1978, and I thought
probably
I thought my 1985 hop-on was really impressive, but you beat me by 7 whole years. Did you imagine how much things would change when you were on the net in the early days and what would have happened?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, in the early days, back when it was ARPANET, it really was a government education laboratory for doing things, and it was for support of all of their missions. The commercial internet didn't come about until the early 1990s, and not until really the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. I remember in 1993 we had to make a big decision about whether to peer to a .com downstream from a .edu.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a huge raging debate. So things have turned around. When did you get started in computer security?
Well, when I was at DEC, I was in VMS development in New Hampshire. And one of the great things about working there was that you were working on the core of the OS, and you could move around and do just about anything, and there were groups that nominally worked on one thing or another. Mm-hmm. And I was in the core executive group that took care of memory management, schedulers, things like that, which also ends up being a lot of security. And I did a lot of work with guys who were formerly tasked with OS security, you know, C2, B1, etc. And that was when I really first started getting formally involved in security.
What year was that? Do you know? You remember?
86, 87.
Mm-hmm. And then you got into cryptography after that, I assume.
Yes. With that, I had, after I left DEC, I had my own first startup, and we were doing collaboration tools on the then very new internet. There were people who said, oh, I can't do collaboration where anybody could sniff my packets and they'd get my ideas. We got to have some way to protect that stuff, and there's this new cryptography stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, there was no SSL. So SSL was not an option because it didn't exist. And I went off to what was, I believe, the very second RSA conference in California because I wanted to learn enough about cryptography to start coding up things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that was there, I met this guy named Bruce who had a duffel bag full of some books that he was getting published.
Did you buy the first one?
I bought the very first one that was sold directly from Bruce, yes.
That's hilarious.
And I handed it to him, and I asked him to autograph it, and his response was, I can't deface a book. And I said, it's not defacement when you're the author.
I think he's changed his mind since
then. He's changed his mind. Oh, yeah. It didn't take long.
Uh-huh. So I was one of those Apple II boys way back in 1981, and I know you worked at Apple in the Advanced Technology Group, which eventually became Apple Labs and then eventually got shot in the head or whatever. Jobs wasn't there then, was he?
No, he was not there.
Did you ever get to meet him?
Yes, I met him a whole bunch of times. I worked at Apple twice. Once, the first time when I was there, I was at Apple in the time before Apple bought Next and Jobs came back.
Right.
And I was there a couple of years after PGP and met Jobs a number of times, did various things for him.
Yeah, and I know you worked on some of Apple's crypto stuff, I guess, at least early versions of the Keychain app and some other stuff like that.
Yes.
So after a storied career all over the place, including PGP, you're now at a company called Silent Circle. And
that's
Silent
correct.
Circle's been all over the news lately. LavaBit shut down its service. According to rumor, they got a national security letter. And then you guys shut your Silent Mail product line down pretty much right around the same time. So what exactly happened?
We heard about what LavaBit had happened to them. And in the intervening time, what we know happened to LavaBit was that it was a grand jury subpoena, not a national security letter. And there is an interesting long story dealing with LavaBit, but going on to what happened with us, we saw that LavaBit had been shut down.
Mm-hmm.
We had been offering a secure email system that was based upon ordinary email server, you know, SMTP, POP, IMAP.
Yep.
It was backed with a PGP Universal server.
Mm-hmm.
And PGP Universal is sort of my baby from PGP Corp days. And it is a server that adds encryption with PGP or SMIME to existing email systems, but it was designed for an organization.
Exactly.
It was designed for the staff that would be running it, would be trusted staff.
Right.
It was not designed for untrusted staff. And this had always been a quandary for us because we have a very high degree of security guarantees that we can give on silent phone and silent text, which mm-hmm. is our voice video calling and texting, because they are absolutely, completely end-to-end. Keys always on your device. We don't know squat about what you're doing.
Right.
But on an email system, there's stored state. There's keys that we may or may not have, depending upon how you, the person running it, has set it up.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people who were using it in the, what I would call, easy mode.
Right, consumer
where we
mode.
Would generate,
yep.
Yeah, we would generate the keys for them, and consequently, ultimately, the security that is there is dependent upon SSL. And when we saw what happened with LavaBit, we had a reasonably quick discussion of what to do about it and decided that since we had never gotten any subpoenas, we'd never gotten anything, and there's only a limited amount of time until you get one of those, that it was best for us to say, hey, this was a great idea pre-Snowden, post-Snowden, it's just not a good idea for us to do this anymore.
Right, so are you trying to create a truly secure email system now for the future?
We had been thinking about that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the architecture that we do for silent text, because silent text is a texting slash IM system, and it has a way to send an equivalent of an MMS. You know,
mm-hmm.
you can send a picture, you can send a PDF, you can really send any file.
So you can send a crypto blob.
Right. You can send any large blob.
Mm-hmm.
And we had noted that the major difference between doing this for texting and doing this for an email system, and I put scare quotes around the word email, is essentially the user experience.
Mm-hmm.
That if you think about really what email is, it's a bunch of files in a bunch of directories. All of your email folders are really just directories, and they're probably sitting on the server in directories named the very same things your folders are.
Mm-hmm.
And your email client is just a viewer into that directory tree of files.
Right. You know, back in the old days, you just reminded me, when I was pretending to be a Unix sysadmin, I screwed up some sticky bit stuff with that directory of files for mail. And I think I lost 3 hours worth of email. Boy, you know, my lab
yep.
almost killed me on that one.
Yep. Yep. So if you look at this, you could take the same architecture and you could turn that into an email system. And this was something that we had been thinking about and working towards. A month or so ago, we ended up meeting up with Ladar finally in person at a privacy conference, and we started talking to him. And we had several other conversations, met up with him again at a different set of events in New York. He was telling us about what he was thinking about of, you know, the way to fix email. And I told him what we had been thinking about, and my developers had been showing him things that they had been working on, which were to walk down that path. And the idea then came up with the, hey, why don't we join forces? Why don't we take these ideas that you guys, where you guys as Silent Circle have been doing, and turn it loose on the whole internet? 'Cause we had been thinking about it as a service that Silent Circle would offer only to its customers.
Right, and so now you're just talking about a different way of doing mail.
Now we're talking about a different way of doing mail.
Is that the thing called the Dark Mail Alliance?
Yes, that's what's now the Dark Mail Alliance.
Okay.
And what we are discussing is a new way to transfer mail, you know, as opposed to the client and the server end.
Right.
How do messages go from point A to point B in a completely end-to-end secure way and with an architecture that uses as many existing bits as we can, because you don't want to go write entirely new protocols if you don't have to, and to do it in a way that anybody can play. So, you know, I will say open source, but it's also beyond open source because, for example, we have been using XMPP/Jabber as our texting substrate, you know, the way that the messages get from point A to point B, because it has an awful lot of desirable characteristics. It is scalable to a huge degree. It's used as the back end for how Facebook does Messenger. For a long time, Google was using it for GTalk. We know that it is a technology that can work for an internet-wide system.
Right, right.
So why not do that?
Right, that's interesting.
And there are lots of XMPP servers that are open source in some terms of what license is it done, what code base, is it supported by people who in the background, this, that, the other thing, and this is what I mean by it being beyond open source. If what we say is, we're going to start using this protocol this way, and similarly, one of the things that we do need to do is to look at how we would do the back end for the storage of things, moving that from being something that only one service would do to anybody could do. There are decisions that have to be made about how we could do that. But if we make a few very easy decisions, it can be which one of these Jabber servers do you want to use? Which one of these cloud storage systems do you want to use?
That's very interesting.
There will be some of them with GPL licenses, BSD licenses, Apache licenses, or even completely commercial systems.
So I understand how you can get a crypto glob from point A to point B, but you still haven't done anything to obscure the pen data, right?
Well, which particular pen data do you want to obscure?
I suppose if you just did which server talks to which server for the entire mail chain, you could just chain it all together and figure out who's talking to who. So to put it in consumer sense, it's the to and the from lines.
Those the to and the from lines, those, no problem. We can obscure those. Well, we can encrypt them.
Right.
Now,
but the machine hops you can't, because it has to. There's got to be address somewhere.
Well, it depends, you know, on what you're trying to obscure.
Right.
What The problem that we have with SMTP now is that there's a whole bunch of stuff that I'll call the envelope. And it includes not only the to and the from and the subject line, but it also includes received headers, which every server that it passes through writes something that includes IP addresses.
Yep.
And they stick with the message forever.
Mm-hmm.
There is both debugging information and logging information that's put in every email message, and it sticks around forever. So every mailman archive of every mailing list in the world has in it data that not only locates people, geolocates and time locates, but tells you what type of computer that they were using.
Right, right.
So
that's the kind of stuff that, you know, in the new world of, by God, they're going to look at all the pen data. We have to think about.
Oh, damn straight. Yeah, absolutely. Damn straight I would. I'm sure that they're looking at that. I mean, really. They'd be fools not to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's not like the NSA is the only one doing it. Everybody's doing it.
Absolutely. The major difference between us and other countries is that we have Ed Snowden and they don't.
We don't actually have them anymore. I think Russia has them, just for the record. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So this is all very interesting. How fast is it going? You know, what are your feelings about how soon there could be a set of, I don't know, designs and implementations that people could begin to use?
I think that we can have prototypes that are real, honest-to-God, working prototypes next year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that actually fixing the email problem is a many years effort.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of backwards compatibility, and you got to con all the big players into playing along.
Well, absolutely. And we know that one of the things that is absolutely mandatory is that we essentially have to have an adapter to be able to kick a message out into the conventional email system,
right,
and accept one from it and push it into the existing system.
Right, right.
So those are things where it is really a multi-year problem.
Yeah.
But being able to do something like, for example, have Silent Circle and LavaBit and anybody else who's willing to roll up their sleeves along to have a small family of servers that work using these new protocols, we think that we can have that done sometime next year.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'm glad you're working on it. Let's talk about your other stuff. So have your phone and texting and video comm systems that you mentioned before seen an uptick in demand since the Snowden revelations?
It's been huge. I mean, sales are up like 400%.
Yeah, but I don't know what
they
were before, we'll assume it
was
big.
That was
a 1 month,
uptick, and it's continuing to grow.
That's good. And, I mean, let's tread on some dangerous ice. So what is your opinion of Snowden?
I have a very favorable opinion of him.
Uh-huh. And this notion of metadata and PEN network stuff, you know, collecting all of that crap, including, you know, Facebook as sort of a turnkey tyranny system that the East German Stasi would have totally loved. How do you feel about all that?
What you said about Facebook, not precisely that. That's an Onion TV article.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Onion did a year or two ago a thing about the CIA reporting to Congress on the status of its Facebook project.
Right.
So you know, that's not like any of that's new.
No, I mean, the problem is this, John, and you know this as well as I do, but it's worth talking about. The people that are building these things are not evil. But if we had some crazy megalomaniac like Hitler show up, that would be a big problem.
And that is what Snowden himself said that his point was that it is the tools that you would need for turnkey totalitarianism.
Yep.
And I think that that's one of the issues themselves. I think that part of the problem is, in fact, that these are not bad people who are doing it. It would be a lot easier if they were bad people.
Exactly. Yep.
The problem is that they are good people who are setting up a system that will be abused 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
And I don't think they even really know that, although they don't have an excuse anymore because we've begun to tell them in no uncertain terms.
Yes, yes. And that is certainly where we need to help them come to the right decision.
Right.
But I described them as being kind of like Boromir in Lord of the Rings. they think that they're good enough and strong enough and pure of heart enough that they can take this immense power of universal surveillance
just
and
for
only
a short
use
while.
It for good.
I love
and
it.
Only use it for good.
Yeah, that's going to work for people that are silver bullet listeners. So that's the good. That's the good news. I'm not sure that analogy would work with the Congress people.
No, it wouldn't. But it works very well, I think.
So let's let's talk about your Silent Circle stuff a little bit more. I know that you had your servers hosted in Canada.
Which, we still do.
Which is one of the Five Eyes countries, so I'm not sure what good that does. I get maybe it does good because Canada has better privacy protection than the U.S. has.
When we started, we did an inventory of what countries have the best privacy laws and regulations. And the two top countries that came up were Switzerland and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, we're now finishing up, even as I speak, a set of servers that are in Switzerland.
Uh-huh.
We picked Canada at first because we can drive there.
That's a reasonable way to pick.
I mean, you know, it's one of your two it's one of the two top choices,
right.
And you can drive there.
Yeah, cool. Where is your guys' offices are in San Francisco mostly?
Our official offices are in Washington D.C. area.
Oh, okay.
That we have our team. We are a very spread out team. We are spread everywhere from Latvia to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. So your view is that the Canadian privacy laws are way stronger than U.S. privacy laws, and that makes it even worth moving your servers
up
there.
Yes.
Yep.
And they have privacy commissioners at both the provincial and national level. They are people whose job it is to help protect privacy, to help create systems that protect privacy. And if you're doing business there, then they are your civil servants whose job it is to help you on your mission. And that's extraordinarily useful to us or any other business that wants to do this, that there's someone that you can go talk to and they'll give you interesting opinions that you know go into the rest of the interesting opinions that people will give you. So that was the major reason that we went for Canada, was that it was one of the two top countries that we surveyed. They have fantastic support, and they were close.
Yeah. So in your view, is privacy just dead in the United States? I mean, can we salvage our situation, or are we toast?
I think that one of the biggest problems that we have is, in fact, the defeatism that is, oh, privacy is toast, you just shouldn't even bother.
Yeah, it started with McNeely, you remember that?
Well, sure. There have been lots of people whose financial interest is in violating privacy who have helped to spread the meme that, well, privacy is over, so therefore, you know, it's not like I'm violating your privacy to line my pockets. No. This is just the tide of history.
Right.
And you're a Luddite. Just open your wallet up and let me reach in now.
Yeah, right. Interesting. All right, I want to change topics a little bit. So you know that software security is near and dear to my heart.
For example,
you can check out the recently released BSIM 5 thingy. There are a lot of security software companies that participate in our community. What do you guys do at Silent Circle for product security?
We have a lot of things that we do internally, which, because we are a new company, there's a lot of things that we do where we are coming up to speed on them.
Yes.
It's difficult for any organization to just hit the ground running and know what they're doing for security.
I couldn't agree more. And plus, when you're a startup and you're moving fast on purpose, you have to make different trade-offs than you might make otherwise.
Yes.
We had the same challenge when I was advising Dacient. You know, and that was a company that was founded by a guy who'd written a software security book. but we had to say, well, we're going to need to dial it back in order to actually build something and get somebody to buy it.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure that was an education all in itself, because there's a lot of people who are in the software security biz who are not software security creators, and it's really easy to say something, and then it's very different when you are the people who have to actually ship the software.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the real world intervenes.
Well, yeah. We work with big software companies all the time, and software security is a challenge from the littlest startup just because of resource constraints to the largest concern just because you have an army of 30,000 developers that you have to control.
Yes.
And everything in between. But I think we've made a lot of progress in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so.
One of the things that we did as well is that we went to a software consulting firm. I'm sorry, not yours. It was Leviathan.
Oh, they're good.
But you know, they're good. You're good. I mean, each of you are people that I recommend to people all the time and say, here's the short list of people that you should go talk to. And we went to Leviathan. They have what they call a virtual security officer program,
mm-hmm.
where you pay them essentially a security person's salary, and you get various things out of their small army of consultants. So, you know, it's actually better than having one person, because mm-hmm. you're getting a little bit of five or six people. So they have been helping us with everything from review of the code itself to setting up our own software security lifecycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's helped us with the operational portion of things. So when we first published our code, which we had wanted to do very shortly after we released the apps, but you know, nothing ever works when you want it to. But
right.
when they finally got out and released, put them up on GitHub, I was pleased that there were only a few piddling things that people had that we hadn't thought of.
Right.
And one issue that was an architectural issue that we went, yep, that's really good, but you know, we need to fix that. But that also means making architectural redos.
Right.
So it was really nice that we survived a whole lot of very, very smart hackers looking through things.
Yeah, you know, I sort of don't really believe that myth about open source, the many eyes thing. I just don't believe that. I think it depends on whose eyes they are, but putting your code out is very brave. That's a good thing to do. I'm not saying that that's bad, but I don't think that that is a substitute for professional methodologies and approaches and tools.
I think that anybody who is doing security software needs to make their source code available.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that it actually adds to the security. Neither do I. The one security oops that we had is that we are using crypto software for our VoIP security that was open source GPL software. And as a matter of fact, the guy who wrote it, Werner Dittmann, works for us. And while it's his code that we are using, all the work that he does for us we put out back onto his own GitHub for
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And that had some relatively simple errors in it that had been sitting there for 6 years.
I remember and, that. And, that was really and, interesting. And
The irony is that we ourselves had put that at the bottom of code that needs to be reviewed.
Yeah, because it was
the
there out for 6 years.
And it's GPL code that's been sitting out on GitHub for 6 years. You can afford to review that last.
Well, see, so that's sort of telling a little bit about who reviews what and how that all works in open source land.
So yeah, I believe that if you're doing security software, you really need to release your code.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a statement about what you're doing. It is transparency. It is opening up the kimono. It is letting people who depend upon it see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that this somehow magically makes your software bug free is shown to be utterly false by many, many things.
Right, right.
When I was at PGP and we published all of our code for years and years and years, the number of bugs that were turned in by people looking at the code could probably be counted on one hand.
Right.
As opposed to the
people
bugs
that you paid
people
to do
who
it.
Ran,
right.
You know, but people who just happened to turn a fuzzer at the code.
Uh-huh.
Didn't read any of the sources. They just turned a fuzzer at it.
Well, that's Charlie Miller does that to some extent.
Generated probably 5 to 10 times more real bugs in the software.
Yep.
So it's definitely a myth. I think that for openness, transparency, and showing that you are really doing quality software, security software has to have published source.
Yeah, well stated. I like how you put that. I have another question for you. It's a selfish question. So I recently got a new cell phone, and getting an S/MIME supporting client set up was a pain in the ass. So why is usability such a pain in the ass when it comes to crypto, and what are you guys doing to fix that?
The reason that it's such a pain in the ass is because, in general, people don't want it. And when push comes to shove in the development environment, somebody's piddling little, oh, but if somebody stands on one foot and bends over this way and does that, it won't be quite as secure as it would, da 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 da.
Right, right.
So you can't do that. And the security people don't come out and say it's got to be usable.
Yeah, some of them do, but they're very rare. I was on a National Academy study about usability, but it just turned into mostly platitudes. Boy, wouldn't it be nice if this stuff were usable.
You know, one of the things that we're doing is that we at Silent Circle are putting usability at absolutely the top of things.
Awesome.
We end up taking flack from a bunch of security people from time to time who don't like some of the things that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, well, it's got to be usable, and that's the thing that we're doing. I mean, for example, our phone app, you start the phone up app, there is a one-time setup process that you do, mm-hmm. but after that, it, you know, and that's really just, you know, connect the thing to the server. After that, it just starts up.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that when you're on a smartphone, you expect that when you push the icon for a phone app, that it just starts up.
Right. Not ask you a bunch of questions and request your mother's maiden name and so on.
And we had a bunch of security people come to us and say, oh, you should put a secondary passcode on this thing. And we said, no, because trust the device. You know, after they've unlocked their device with their 8 characters, her passcode, you then want them to do another 8 character passcode. And oh, by the way, it'll probably be the same one that they just did again.
Exactly.
For this thing that what we've seen time and time again is that when you have a service that is secure but hard to use, and one that is insecure but easy to use. People use the insecure one.
Yeah, you know, so, we put that most pithily just by saying, given a choice between dancing pigs and security, the world will always choose dancing pigs.
Yes, absolutely. So we also did some interesting things, like our app logs in to our server. It authenticates for you. And part of what we do when you set up the app to talk to the server is that the server gives you what is essentially a username and password, but the password is a 128-bit random string. And so rather than you type in puppies or 123456,
right,
we have a 128-bit thing that we store on the keychain of the device, and it sends to you. And this is another case of, it isn't quite as secure as it could be, but it's more secure than the 99.9% case.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. So thanks. This has been great. I got one other question for you. It has nothing to do with security. What's the latest piece of fiction that you absolutely loved that everybody needs to read?
I have been mostly reading nonfiction.
I see.
Now, I reread recently Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine.
Oh, cool.
Because I had not read it since I was a kid, and that was something that parts of it were coming back through my memory, and I thought I ought to reread it.
Cool.
I've also started to read Laura Lippman's Tess Monahan stories.
Uh-huh.
And I'm in the middle of those.
Well, there you go. Thanks very much. Thanks for your time today,
welcome.
John.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P Magazine includes our interview with embedded wireless security expert Wenyuan Zhu, a professor at University of South Carolina. The issue focuses on identity and integrity. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.